The Buck O'Neill Bridge, formerly known as the Broadway Bridge, crosses the Missouri River just west of the city market. And there's a spot under the ramp where pavement turns to gravel. If you're walking around over there and you look out on the water, you get this charmingly industrial view of crisscrossing metal supports on the horizon. It's a good-looking bridge, but it needs serious work, so much work, that the city is trying to figure out whether to fix it or build a whole new bridge in its place. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and today's show is about that conundrum. Daniel Serta is our urban design guy, and Daniel, I can't be the only one who's gotten attached to that view.
Oh, absolutely. It's just such a sort of prescient way of coming into the city and arriving and, you know, knowing that you're going from sort of the edge out there toward really the not just the skyline, but really arriving. There's such a sense of arrival there.
I agree. I mean, when I call that charmingly industrial, I feel like that word charm is a red flag, though. I mean, if you're touring a house with a real estate agent and they talk about the charm of these old bones, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Well, means work.
Yeah, it's a word that's not always used, and it might say more about its use than you want it to. But no, there really is. There's the, you know, I often tell people, when you think about what it is that defines a city, you know, how do you know that you've arrived in a city? Usually one of the first things people will say is the skyline. You've got, you know, that outline of the buildings, and you have that there. But you also have the actual fabric. And it's interesting you mentioned the industrial part, because what's happened over the last 15 years or so, especially in the River Market, is that what used to just be industrial backwater, like some other parts of the city, like the Crossroads and the West Bottoms, has become increasingly alive. It's a place that people live. It's a place that people go to. It's a destination in and of itself.
Are you saying industrial is not alive?
No. It's perception. It's perception,
right?
Because often it's stunning. You know, there are so many industrial landscapes that do define the city, but they don't necessarily define the city as people's sense of an experience or of a place. It's sort of the pass-through areas that you don't think of as being terribly active. And there you have active freight rail and, you know, but really the arrival point of the original city, literally, in terms of the Hannibal Bridge crossing being there right next to the O'Neill. But it is actual on-the-ground lived experience that is starting to change people's perception of that area, not just to think of it as industrial, but to think of it as a place that you want to be. And that din of the trains and in the background becomes sort of almost the stage scene, part of the stage scenery for a lot of other kinds of activities that are happening day to day now.
Brian Kidwell is here, too. He's an engineer with the Missouri Department of Transportation. And Brian, what is going on with the Buck O'Neill Bridge right now?
Yeah, the bridge is a little over 60 years old. It's got a lot of corrosion issues, a lot of what we call pack rust, where the salt in the water has gotten into some of the riveted connections, and that expands. And it basically tears itself apart over time.
So that's what that charm is?
The charm for engineering purposes is a nice, healthy, safe bridge we don't have to worry about. This one is a little sketchier than that. It's it does have a lot of significant structural problems. We actually have a $50 million rehab program for fiscal year 19 where we're going to go in. Currently programmed a year and a half to 2 year closure to work on this bridge to get it back in good shape for the next 20, 30 years.
We're going to come back to that closure issue and the big projects ahead, which that's a big deal, and I want to get into it. But I also want to better understand what exactly is not working about the bridge or is sketchy, as you put it.
What's really not working is the safety aspect. If you drive that bridge, you'll see pedestrians walking across those graded drains out there in the median and the edges. They were never designed for that. It's not safe. You're right next to live traffic. Folks, I guess, need to get across, and they'll put themselves in harm's way. But that safety aspect's probably the number one. The next one is about half the traffic on that bridge goes to downtown, and about half of it is going to I-35. There are some designs out there
now. You
mean
heading south?
Yes. But what happens is you come down and you introduce those stoplights, so everybody ends up waiting to get into downtown or to get on the interstate.
So there's just a flow issue.
Since the 50s, when this thing was designed and built, the traffic patterns have changed. The needs, the use has changed. But we still got that old bridge out there, and now it's got some serious structural needs.
When you talk about a bridge seeming sketchy, my initial assumption, maybe this is a pessimistic or like fear-based assumption, is like, oh man, maybe this bridge is not going to hold up under the weight that it's carrying. Is that a concern?
No, the MoDOT's job is to keep everything safe. And if it's open, the public can be assured that it is safe. But it's our job to watch the deterioration, anticipate where it's going to be in a year and 2 years, and prepare projects in time so that we avoid any emergency closure situation. This one is not a traffic issue. It's really kind of tearing itself up from the inside out due to that pack rusting and some of the corrosion problems.
When was it built?
54, 55, I believe.
So is this part of like a larger trend of infrastructure built at around that time, things that we're dealing with in cities in general right now?
Yeah, I think all across the nation, folks are seeing aging infrastructure, and really our generations grew up without having to make a big investment. Our parents and grandparents really built the system that America enjoys today. It's wearing out, and now comes the funding question, and a lot of people are just not that excited to reach in their pocket to replace all this stuff that has been around for decades.
So now we're getting into the politics of it. This question that we're asking is really a question about when you've got a situation like this, a bridge that's in part kind of defined an aspect of your cityscape, an aspect of what people experience when they're approaching your downtown from a particular direction or leaving it from another. It's not going to hold up as is. But it sounds like the investment is going to be huge, whether you renovate the existing bridge and maintain that familiar old site that people are used to, or if you just scrap it and start over.
Right.
These are both on the table, as far as I understand it.
In concept, yeah, they're both on the table. In reality, we have $50 million that we have allocated a couple years from now. Some concepts that have been looked at, have been studied, have a price tag of $200 to maybe $220 million. MoDOT does not have that kind of funding available. So if something, the public is talking about, we don't put that kind of money into an old bridge. If you're going to spend $50 million, let's put it towards a new bridge that better meets the needs, better serves pedestrians.
And what would that look like? What would a new bridge of your wildest dreams look like?
I think the $200 million solution looks more like a Heart of America type bridge. It's a basic plain get across the river bridge. I think it would be angled, the south end would be angled more towards the west, towards I-35 for a direct connection. And there would be.
So kind of bypassing downtown a little bit more?
With the main bridge, but then you would have ramps going back to Broadway. So all the movements would still exist. It would just not, it wouldn't go through that stoplight configuration.
And then, so that's a new bridge, but what if you're looking at the question of fix the bridge we've got or tear it down and build a new bridge, what are the pros and cons on each side?
Well, if we're looking at fixing the bridge, we invest $50 million of the public's money, and we get back exactly what they have out there today, a bridge that they can drive on, that you wait in traffic on. It doesn't handle the pedestrian bicycle needs. So you basically spent $50 million just for the reassurance that what you're driving on is safe and will be safe for the next 25 years.
I get the feeling I know where you stand on this.
That's as much funding as we have available. That was a pretty heavy lift to actually get the $50 million put together. We have 16 Missouri River bridges in the Kansas City district that we're responsible for. We have 50 major bridges over 1,000 feet long. There's 50 of those in the Kansas City district. So there are a lot of needs out there. This is just one of them, and we do have to spread the resources around and try and keep the entire system up and running.
So if you were to build a new bridge, and that would come with possible changes in terms of like flow of traffic and bigger design issues, more than just structural improvements. And I wonder, like, for you, what do you think it takes to sell that? Can you sell that?
Well, we're really not selling it. What we're doing is we're doing what we can. We programmed this rehab job, very unpopular. It's got a significant, up to a 2-year closure with it. Not popular at all, but it is the only one that we can count on. It's one we can fund. We know what we're getting. We feel like it'd be irresponsible for us to just say, oh, hey, a $200 million new bridge would be great. It would get folks where they want to go faster. It would be safer. We should do that. Well, we don't have the money. So we're going to end up sitting back and doing nothing, and that bridge will end up closing itself due to the structural needs. So we don't have time to just sit back and wish. We have told the region that a new bridge would be great. And if you guys want to fund it, we stand ready. We'll take our rehab money. We'll do anything we can. But the region's going to need to come up with quite a bit of money.
With either scenario, I mean, where we are now is partly a result of just time, the passage of time. But partly when people choose materials and when people lay out a path for infrastructure, it's not always possible. I mean, you try, but it's not always possible to imagine the transportation needs of decades and decades into the future, or the like living and commerce patterns of decades and decades into the future, how the city's going to be used, even what kind of transportation is going to carry goods. That we have all these old bridges that were meant for trains, you know, that just that whole process of figuring out the future, it seems like a tall order, whether you're fixing a bridge or rebuilding.
Yeah, and that's where Daniel and his field, urban planning, that expertise really comes into play, is trying to stay in touch with what the future could look like and being prepared for it as best you can. Back when this bridge was built, it was a big deal just to get across the river. It was a huge barrier. So just being able to get from north to south and back home again was a major accomplishment. You see a lot of those old steel trusses. That steel was cheaper back in the day, and we built lots and lots of trusses, and now we switch more to concrete. Technology's changed. We've got pre-stressed girders and concrete girders, and so, yeah, it just, things do keep evolving.
Daniel, talk to us some more about this bigger question underneath the question. I mean, mm-hmm. We're talking about whether to rebuild the Broadway Bridge, which, of course, is now called the Buck O'Neill Bridge, and there isn't, it sounds like there's not money for that option, or whether the better option is to fix the bridge you've got. But this is a question that doesn't just apply to this bridge.
No, it's a tension that's always there. And the way I would cast it, you know, planning, we always try to step back, but we're also involved in the day-to-day as well. And so typically the way that I would distinguish that is between what I would call incremental planning, which is just keeping up with the needs of today, versus more visionary planning, which is stepping back and looking at a 20 to 50-year time horizon, looking at how these larger forces are changing. Implied in all of that is something really important with Brian's saying, which is that there has to be a sort of collective consensus that the allocation of resources needed to really change how we do things and make a sort of monumental generational kind of change. At some point, there has to be a decision made about that. You simply can't just keep restriping and repaving. You know, you've got to think, is this bridge in the right place? Do we need to look at something larger? And so that's the inherent tension here. It's between the incremental and the broader visionary look. One of the things I think is so interesting about this, I mentioned this to the producer last week, the first conversation that I was involved in on this specific topic was about 15 years ago. There was a meeting that was hosted by the Downtown Council that involved engineers, probably Brian's predecessors in his role at MoDOT. And the engineers were largely talking about the incremental piece. There's this, this, and this. And they were talking about the larger loop around downtown Kansas City. And an architect colleague of mine, who's no longer in Kansas City, but has been here for a while, Kevin Klinkenberg, said something to the effect of, well, why are we just looking at the sort of day in, day out? Why don't we look at the bigger picture of, you know, stepping back and take this? And one of the engineers said, well, you know, we're not looking at sort of radical alternatives here. We're just looking at the more, you know, mundane pieces of this. That's not our charge. We've got to do this. And I made the point in that conversation back in 2002 of, you know, why aren't we looking at the larger vision? And I think a large part of the answer to that was specifically with regard to the Broadway Bridge with the North Loop specifically. We weren't ready to have that conversation yet.
But why not? I mean, is that something specific to Kansas City, or is that a is that part of the national trend too?
Well, the ins and outs of it are part of the Kansas City conversation, but that's always the case. So, you know, there are these moments where you kind of have to act. I think when you have a situation like what's happened with the Broadway Bridge, where, you know, Brian's got a timetable, not only where there's a window of opportunity for funding, but you know that there are specific needs that have to be addressed in a relatively short frame of time. And in order to literally to keep that bridge open and operating, something's got to happen in the way of making those repairs soon. That sort of forces the question. And there wasn't a circumstance like that 15 years ago. It was 15 years ago, and the conditions were not the same. But the other thing that was different 15 years ago, I alluded to this a little while ago, is the River Market wasn't what it is today. Downtown wasn't what it is today. And it was jumping a little bit ahead of the question, because that conversation has happened in other contexts.
But with infrastructure, don't we almost have to jump ahead of the urgent need?
Oh, we always do. And, you know, the last point at which you want to be dealing with a major infrastructure conversation is in a moment of crisis. You know, it's sort of like the situation with Harvey in Houston or Katrina in New Orleans. I mean, sometimes the question absolutely, your hand absolutely gets forced where there's been a lot of delay. You don't want to end up in that circumstance. But again, going back, you know, there's a handful of examples of this where we've had to kind of start working through that.
At the risk of sounding, getting into a rabbit hole here.
Sure.
The airport, it sounds like, is an example of
this. The airport absolutely is an example. You know, about the same time, 2002, right after, not long after 9/11, there were incremental changes made to the airport. You know, there was a major rehab program that was undertaken right after 9/11. One of the unfortunate things that happened was it didn't accommodate for all of the changes and security requirements that 9/11 sort of forced upon us. And that's part, it's not the only reason, but it's part of the reason why we're now looking at the airport in a much larger context.
We're off to a break, but go ahead and call us at 816-235-2888 if you feel strongly about the old bones of the city's infrastructure, those charming old features they just don't make like they used to, or if you're tired of nostalgia and just want stuff that works, stuff that's shiny and functional and new and does what we want it to do. 816-235-2888. Tell us about the times the city got it right, got it wrong. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about how we go about updating the city's infrastructure, whether we take a visionary approach of starting afresh and making a whole new vision for our future, or if we go ahead and fix what we've got, take those charming old bones and make them work for us here in 2017 and beyond. I'm here with Daniel Serta of Insight Planning and the KCATA Board of Commissioners. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
And Brian Kidwell, he's an engineer with MoDOT, and he's been talking to us about the future of the Buck O'Neill Bridge and a related project, Beyond the Loop. Talk to me about Beyond the Loop.
Beyond the Loop is it's actually following up on a conversation where what if we took part of the north side of the loop out of service? What if we made it a smaller footprint? What would that do to connectivity and access to and from I-70? What would that make more real estate available for more increased development downtown? It's kind of a what if. What's possible? What could be done? What are the impacts? What are the financial impacts? What would it do to the community downtown?
Do you get kind of like excited about these possibilities as you start exploring them?
I think we like to make things better. We want to make things better and safer. But what the definition of better is really a regional decision. There's always somebody that advocates for and loves an idea, and there'll be an equal number of people that think that's the worst thing they've ever seen and we shouldn't spend money on it. So there's always this dialogue and this back and forth and what is the right solution for the overall community and for the overall community 20-30 years in the future. It takes a big conversation. It takes a lot of public resources, and it takes a really robust, thoughtful conversation to get yourself in the right place.
As someone, though, who is in on these conversations, you know, you've talked about that funding is hard to come by and that getting the public to want to invest in just giant infrastructure projects is challenging. And that I can't help but wonder if there's some personal disappointment after you have imagined something, imagined what is possible.
No, not at all. It's the public assets. It's the public infrastructure. It's the public money. I mean, we really do serve the public, and we want to. The hardest part of it is really capturing what the actual community, what the individual citizens really want in the broadest terms. It's easy. There's always louder, more voiceful special interests and activists for different pieces and parts. You know, there are people that they want all the highway system to be smaller, less sprawl, more urban density. You know, the more bridges and
rein it in.
Yeah. And that's okay. You know, that makes some sense. There's other people that want to be able to go further and get there easier and less congestion. And they want to build more, and that's okay too. But that comes at a price. And even doing nothing, just taking care of what's already built, still comes at a significant expense when we get into these major river crossings.
Daniel, what are you hearing in all of this? I mean, there are always going to be challenges, but when we talk about picturing, you know, a more visionary future, are there visions that it's hard for you to let go of, or I don't know?
Well, I think there's the vision of the past, and then there's the vision of going forward. I mean, you know, one of the things I often tell people is you have to realize no matter how bad a situation might seem, no matter how convoluted something might seem, you know, people often find themselves, well, you know, what were they thinking when they did this, right? You know, whether it's a traffic problem or just the fact that, you know, for example, a lot of buildings were lost in the cycle of building a highway. Well, the reality is somebody thought that was a good idea at some point. This conversation happened a couple of generations ago, and there was a consensus at that point. And, you know, historically, building a highway loop around downtown was a response to everything from sort of, you know, the disinvestment that was happening downtown to the sense that this would create a new future, it would create new opportunity, it would create better mobility for people. It has played itself out through a couple of life cycles and probably differently than people prognosticated.
The whole loop concept has?
The whole loop concept has.
And explain that, though.
Well, you know, I think there was the sense that, A, if you build this loop, downtown's demise, so to speak, will be forestalled. And in fact, there will be an entirely new, vibrant future.
Because people will have to drive through downtown to get to all these
exactly.
new suburbs.
And if you think about it just in terms of a simple chronology, you know, these decisions were initially thrown out there in the 1940s and 1950s. They were built in the 1950s and 1960s. And the reality is in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, more businesses and more people left downtown. You know, to the point that by the 90s,
because we were thinking about revisions. Because you can't actually just drive by and say, hello, downtown.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, there's a fair argument to be made, and this was true not just in Kansas City, in most major cities, that the highway investments that were made, in fact, made it easier for people to leave downtown and not be downtown and be out on the edges. So that didn't resolve itself. You know, there's been an entire other cycle now going on for almost two decades of major reinvestment in downtown Kansas City. It is at a point in terms of opportunity that there are a lot of downtown advocates that are saying, you know, there's immense opportunity here for rethinking not just whether that highway ought to be there, but if that highway wasn't there, what better use could we make of that real estate?
Politically, is that opportunity there?
Politically, we're in very challenging times. You know, Brian and I have had this conversation many times over the years. You know, we're in a state where, you know, multiple efforts to do things like raise the gasoline tax to fund highway improvements have not been successful. There has been discussion about alternative financing mechanisms. Brian, I'm not putting this out in front of you, so cover your ears. But, you know, we can't probably politically have a serious conversation about something like a toll option for a bridge replacement literally in the state because it just politically will not fly.
Why?
It just hasn't. I mean, there have been a lot of discussions, everything from, you know, widening I-70 statewide as a tollway and that kind of thing. There has never been any significant level of political support statewide. behind getting that kind of thing done. And so there are some options financing wise that are just very, very difficult to move a conversation forward. But we have had, you know, there's some other examples of success to point to. You know, Brian and I know as well each other as well as I do, because we worked very closely on the Kip Bond Bridge project a dozen years ago. It's hard to believe it's been that long, but time flies. And, you know, there was a significant question at one point there about how much financial support there could be for building that bridge replacement. There were a lot of competing interests, as Brian alluded to earlier, people that wanted a wider, larger bridge, people that wanted a sort of a signature span, people that wanted bicycle and pedestrian access across it. There were a lot of different competing interests in that entire dialogue. But, you know, that bridge has been in operation almost a decade now. And there were a lot of those things that came together, everything from additional funds to make it possible for it to be more of a signature piece of infrastructure in the landscape of the city, to there was a concrete commitment that MoDOT made in that process and lived up to with providing a bicycle and pedestrian crossing on the Heart of America Bridge. That came directly out of that process of planning that new bridge. So these things do happen. It's not simply a pipe dream. It's not simply wishful thinking. But the planning discussion around these is a long process as well. We were working directly on that for 4 years while the project was actually under formal planning, engineering, and construction. So, you know, these things don't happen overnight. But these conversations do sometimes coalesce in ways that do create this sort of generational shift in what's possible.
Well, let's talk to Mark. Mark is calling from Lee's Summit at 816-235-2888. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
Well, I'm a Metro bus driver, and one of my routes is going up to I-29 and Boardwalk, and across the bridge going north every day. And there's an enormous amount of foot traffic on the bridge that shouldn't have any foot traffic. And so, you know, it's very scary because, you know, not only you're watching for car traffic, but you're kind of watching for these people on the side of the road that, you know, really shouldn't be there. And then it's on both sides, it's kind of got very sharp, once you get off the bridge, a very sharp turn to the right. And
is this if you're headed south?
If you're headed north.
If you're headed north, okay.
Yeah. And then wasn't the bridge originally for the downtown airport? And at one time, wasn't it a tow bridge?
Well, let's get some answers on that, and then we'll talk a little bit more about this idea that the way people are using this bridge is not something that the people who built it had imagined. But first, this question about history.
Well, it was built originally as a toll bridge, and actually it's relatively recent in the life of the bridge, probably less than half the lifespan it's been under MoDOT's control and operated without the tolls. We mentioned the Bond Bridge replaced the Paseo Bridge. The Paseo Bridge was originally built as a toll bridge as well. Again, I think there's a little more political acceptance of doing that back then. But the larger issue, which is, as you mentioned, the bridge being used in ways that was not intended or not anticipated, that's a huge issue. The other issue that the driver mentioned, which is the alignment, and Brian alluded to this earlier, the alignment of that bridge for the demands that are put on it day to day, the speeds at which vehicles drive on the bridge is not optimal. A large part of the bottleneck that exists in downtown Kansas City getting across the river has to do with the Broadway interchange itself up there at 6th Street. Because, you know, essentially the way that traffic really sort of wants to flow is sort of along the west edge of downtown, from the south, from Johnson County in through and across the river. And you can't do that. You literally cannot do that. You actually have to get off the highway, so to speak, get to Broadway, come to a controlled, you know, signaled intersection, take a left-hand turn to go north across the highway, and then get onto this bridge, and then follow the alignment of the bridge that was built before there was an interstate system.
Daniel, you know, you're talking about this example. We've talked about the airport, and I know you have others, mm-hmm. and maybe you can spell this out with some of those other ones too.
Sure.
Just the it feels a little like at times people's emotional attachment to some aspect of the city's infrastructure, or and possibly just a political, a a political will against it for whatever reason cuts against a current of just objective need.
Well, sure. But I think the objective need piece here is paramount, because I think there's a few things you could say about that. On the one hand, the Beyond the Loop discussion is happening in large part because that segment of the downtown loop does not handle the level of traffic that it was expected to handle, in part because of the redundancy in the loop. The fact that you have not only a north loop, but a south loop, you have 670 crossing through there as well. So there's the issue of sort of the operation and the demand that's on different segments of the system. But with specific regard to the bridge, the example of pedestrians crossing the bridge or bicyclists wanting to cross the bridge, there's a lot of commuters that bicycle, as well as recreational bicycling that happens on both sides of the river and especially near the downtown airport.
Why would this have been so hard to foresee when the bridge was built?
Because the there were really two kind of incremental decisions that were made back then. One was purely about creating a crossing over the river for vehicles. There was a crossing for vehicles. That was the Hannibal Bridge. There was an upper deck that was used for automobile traffic, and it was overcapacity. And so a new bridge was needed to replace that. So there was that decision initially about building it. And then the other decision that we laid on top of that was when the interstate system was developed not very long afterwards, that this would become kind of one of the primary spurs in that system. And what's happened over time is and this has been true for my entire life, the bridge and all of the approaches to it have really not functioned very efficiently when it comes to handling interstate level traffic. If you ask anybody, what's your biggest headache about getting into or out of downtown Kansas City, you won't hear any more vocal complaints about congestion and getting in or out than you'll hear about getting onto and off of the Broadway Bridge or the O'Neill Bridge.
Well, so back to this question of fix the one we've got or build anew. With something like bridges, is the idea ever floated, what if we had more bridges?
Well, I would cast it more as, what if we had the resources to do whatever we could possibly do, right? And that's the hard reality. We live in a resource-constrained society, and when it comes to the actual dollars to make these changes, that's why it's so difficult. And that's why we have continued to sort of, almost hobble along with what might be seen as a half solution, because it is much easier incrementally over time to continue to repair the infrastructure we have in place rather than kind of take the big gulp and step back and make the big push and the big lift, as Brian said earlier, and fundamentally change how things are going to work.
Other than resources, is there an argument for the old thing? Let's keep the old thing. We love the old thing.
Well, you mentioned the sentimental aspect of it. I think that's part of it. But I know part of this conversation, as it's emerged over the course of the last 6 months to a year or so in particular, has been, even if a new bridge is built, it would not be cheap to simply dismantle the old bridge and make it go away. So part of that conversation is, if a new bridge is built, perhaps the old bridge could be used and repurposed for more of the pedestrian and bicycle crossing. And I think that's a very healthy part of that debate. Again, that still remains to be determined if that's the most feasible thing to do, if the new vision and the new bridge it becomes a possibility.
So, Daniel, thinking about, is there an example from Kansas City's past, or from another city's past for that matter, where we could look at this kind of crossroads and say, here's a community really being creative or really taking this moment and making a good decision?
There are examples all over the country of communities stepping back and taking that. And not just, I could give you a whole range of examples, but just to be very specific to these kinds of circumstances where you have older bridges and older highway segments and that kind of thing. Almost every major city has stepped back and looked at how they built highways in and around their downtown. And not every community has decided, let's totally change things, but some have. There are half a dozen communities around the United States right now that are in the process of essentially decommissioning what were major legs of the interstate system that either ran right through or immediately adjacent to their downtown areas. And there are other communities that are decking over those highways to create more connective tissue, so to speak.
But what do you mean by decking over?
But basically building a lid, it's really a complex system of different kinds of bridges that basically cap over the highway segments, because part of what those highway segments did at the time they were built was typically they were run through established neighborhood areas It was not a blank slate of an undeveloped city that, you know, interstates were built into, and every
major
city.
So you can, like, rebuild neighborhoods
over. So the idea is, yeah, essentially build a physical deck that would create, you know, pedestrian level, block-to-block connections that create opportunities for parks and other development to happen above what was sort of the scar of where a highway was inserted.
Daniel Serta, Insight Planning and KCA Board of Commissioners, thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And Brian Kidwell, engineer with MoDOT, talking to us about the future of the Buck O'Neill Bridge. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Well, up next, the so-called losingest team in baseball does not want your pity. We'll have a chat with the manager of the Salina Stockade. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm joined by a player and former manager for the Salina Stockade, an independent league team in Kansas that's had a really rough season, if you go by the numbers. Just 18 wins and 72 losses. A recent article had some fun with that record and called Salina Stockade the losingest team in baseball. Daniel Aldrich, I hear you think that's unfair.
Yeah, I do. I mean, well, the record speaks for itself. That might be true, but I think if you read between the lines on through the statistics and the record and see the improvement that we made, it kind of tells a different story.
Tell me that story.
So, Salina Stockade took over for a franchise that folded in the American Association, which is a prestigious independent league. We took over. I guess the Pecos League got contracted to field this team about 2 weeks before the season, so it was very makeshift. We had a 2-day spring training.
So, there's a new spot that opened up in this more prestigious league, and you find out about it with 2 weeks' notice.
Right, and they need somebody to fill in the schedule. The logistics, they needed a team basically to an easy fix, and we were it.
Why did they pick you?
Andrew Dunn is the commissioner of the Pecos League, and he's run a longstanding league. He has a pool of players that he was able to choose from, and basically just with that time frame, he was the guy to get it done, and he did.
And so you guys have not played many home games this season, and that's part of it. The stadium, your home stadium, didn't meet the standards for this new league. How did that play into what's happened this past season?
Correct. We had, I think we had 6 or 7 games at the home stadium. And even when we were there, we were still the visiting team. So we were the road team for 100 games this season.
Man, I mean, what does that feel like to you? Especially that can't be what you were counting on going into this season.
I mean, we knew what was in front of us. We knew what we were up against. I mean, we knew that it was that we were the road team. We weren't gonna have the fan support or any support really for that matter. We had vans, passenger vans, as opposed to, you know, other teams are on sleeper buses. We did get to bus eventually when we went on some of the longer trips, but we knew it was gonna be a tough season, and it definitely tested our mettle. But these guys, I mean, they're like the Iron Men of baseball. This was like unbelievable. You know, minor league baseball is known for being really grueling, but this was especially that.
Well, I would say that America has kind of a love affair with losing baseball teams. If you look at our movies, Bad News Bears, Major League.
Right.
We just love that.
And that's kind of, I guess, the story that I want to tell is a team that started out 2-35, which was probably, I mean, that's got to be like a historical pace for. And that, it got pretty bad, and a team that got a lot better, and by the end of the season was playing. I mean, it was a good product. We were putting we had teams up against the ropes almost every night. We were playing clean baseball. We were, despite all of the things we had against us, and it was just. I mean, it's a really good story, and it was really fun to watch and be a part of.
You were saying that minor leagues are always grueling and that this was especially grueling. Can you take me to the moment where you felt at your most challenged, like looking at the situation ahead of you going, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into?
Right. Well, that was probably when we were, I think, I'm pretty sure the record was 2-35, and we were in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I think we lost all three games by double digits. And that was, and we'd gotten smacked around a little bit before that, but that was about the worst it'd gotten. And it was, you know, we had some of the older guys kind of get together and say, like, we need to right this ship. And you know, really, I didn't know if that was going to happen. But we went down to Texas. We played a day game that day, got beat really bad. Drove through the night down to Texas, 14-hour trip. And we actually, our pitcher who was going to start, who started that game in Texas that day, was a 33-year-old veteran. He was only supposed to come for a couple weeks, and he was going to go on to pitch for a better league, but he decided that he'd had enough, and that was going to be his last game. And he actually pitched a complete game, and we won that day. And that was kind of a turning point. If you look at the record from there on out, which is a cool story that, you know, got overlooked.
So do you think that you did have, because the thing about all these movies about losing teams is that they have their, you know, triumphant movie moment where the losing team stops being a losing team. Your record overall
right.
still is not good, but
no.
But the improvement, like that turnaround, do you feel like you had your movie moment, or is it coming?
I guess there wasn't a movie moment, but from that game on, I think we went 8 in our next 25, which is a pretty significant improvement. And just an interim manager, somebody actually took over for me, which is another example of just the daily uncertainties that we had. We had three managers over the season. But during my time, we were 7-15. I think we lost five games in walk-off fashion. We had the lead in the ninth inning and blew the lead and ended up giving the game. So we were really playing good. And we had a goal to get, initially it was 25 and then it was 20, and they didn't end up getting there, so I guess there wasn't that, you know, that moment that you're talking about. But, you know, it still was just a good thing to see guys making the best out of a pretty much impossible situation. And like I said, it really was a good product. We really connected with a lot of fans, and we had pockets of fans who watched the way we played and saw that guys were excited.
Tell me about those fans, because I have noticed on Facebook that there are people who it seems like are really passionate about this team and will not give up on you guys.
Right. Well, for example, in Cleburne, that's a place we went a lot. We, you know, we had a church feed us. We had a group of fans.
Where
also
is Cleburne? Sorry.
Cleburne's in Texas, near Fort Worth, Dallas area. It's a small town in Texas. They just built, they're actually a new franchise as well. They're small town. They're really also, they love their baseball. They've really rallied around it and they got a good following. But I had a fan actually come up to me before a game and say, hey, we only come when you guys are in town. We love watching you guys play. I mean, just stuff like that. It's cool to hear.
What's your history with the sport?
I played collegiately at College of Charleston and was, signed as a free agent out of Cape Cod. It's a very good summer college baseball league, and I signed with the Yankees. I had one season with them.
The Yankees?
Right.
Just checking.
Yes.
Because that's quite a credential. I'm just saying.
Yeah. No. I played affiliated baseball. I didn't make it up to the highest level, but I played low A and spent some time in short season and extended spring training, but that was also a great experience. But
so what has this season felt like to you? I mean, I think you have put a very rosy perspective on something that a lot of people would find disappointing, but I know that when you're passionate about something and working hard at it, you have to believe in it. And I just, as someone who had this moment in the Yankees, it just seems like there might have been some hard times.
Right. Yeah. I've dealt with some injuries over the years in my pro career, like like many, didn't really turn out the way I expected. Just kind of another casualty of the game. But this, for me, I feel, this season, it came to a breaking point where I was, just couldn't play. It wasn't going to happen. And I didn't feel like banging my head against the wall anymore. Physically, yes. I started off really well, but statistically, and I was playing well, but my performance started to go, and my health started to deteriorate again, and I just had enough. And I was asked to stay on as assistant, and eventually was kind of thrust into that head manager position.
And I want to ask you about quickly, like, this manager situation. One of the managers this season sounds like quite a character, someone who had not played above a little league level.
Yeah, that's correct. He's JD Drotty. That's actually, if you read the Ringer article, it's very long, just a warning. and most of it really seems to be about JD Drotty. It's almost like the title is inappropriate for the article because they talk about us a little bit, and then he'll go on about JD Drotty for a long time.
Because he is an entertaining character.
He definitely is. He also was in the New York Times, so he's what I know about him, I think he has something like 80 combat missions. And
as a veteran.
He's a Harvard, has a Harvard law degree. He's just a jack of all trades of sorts. He just does a lot of different stuff. And then baseball seems to just be something that he just picked up at some point and started doing. I don't know how he got into it, but he's sorry, go ahead.
Was it strange to play baseball for someone who had not played above a little league level himself?
Well, he definitely has a knowledge of the game. He understands baseball. It was at times a little frustrating because, we're playing the Kansas City T-Bones, who I'm sure you're familiar with, and they have, Frank White, who's he's one of their coaches. I'm pretty sure he's in the Royals Hall of Fame. They got guys like that, and this has definitely got to be the highest level that Drotty had coached at. But he did a very good job. He was very popular with the players. He was a great administrator, and he's definitely a character.
I want to bring in Alan from Kansas City, Kansas, who's seen you guys in action and wants to tell us a little bit about what he's noticed. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Good morning.
Thanks for jumping in.
Hey, this is great. Daniel, hello. Nice to talk to you again. A little bit about this team. Man, I was in the locker room. I could not believe the spirit of this team. As far as enthusiasm, no team beats them. There's none, hands down.
What showed you that? I mean, did you have something that you observed where you were like, this is what it means to be a spirited baseball team? And just quickly, because we're kind of on our way out.
Okay. Quickly, you go into a locker room of most losing teams, and these guys are having a blast. These guys are just having so much fun. One quick thing about JD, he also wrote a ballet score.
Okay. Well, that is an unusual kind of credential in and of itself. Thank you so much, Alan.
Everybody have a good one today.
Thanks, you too. Daniel, tell me about the spirit. I mean, what kept you guys going all season long?
I think it was just we really rallied at a certain point after we'd gotten to that really deep depth, that lowest point. Something I noticed was the beginning of the season, many of the guys would almost kind of crowd and huddle at the back corner of the dugout, and the body language wasn't good. And by the end, everyone was up and kind of into the game, and we were basically competing in every single game, even when we lost. And I know that the fact that we were competing definitely raised spirits. I mean, there was a big turnaround as far as the product that was on the field. It was not good. For 35-40 games, but it got a lot better, and that's the story.
I mean, just real quick before we go, do you have advice that coming out of this season for people who are in their own challenging circumstances for persevering and getting through those rough times?
I don't know. I think that a lot of it just depends on people's makeup, and we just had a really good group of guys, and they were able to just stay positive throughout that. I don't know if everyone's able to do that, but they did a wonderful job.
Well, our time is up. Daniel Aldridge with us from the Salinas Stockade. Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure.
You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. We'll also have our discussion about the future of the Buck O'Neill Bridge ready for you to listen to. So check those both out if you missed any part of it. Tomorrow we'll be talking with local writer Michelle Johnson about her newest projects. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.